democracynow.org. For more information, everyone is welcome. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Paul Huckabee. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. The time is 5 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland. And up next, as you know, is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Pueblo Unido PDX one-year anniversary on May 19th from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center in Portland. Join Portlanders in celebrating the recent success and helping community members win their cases against deportation and get out of immigration detentions. This event will feature a reception with the silent auction, raffle, light refreshments, and more. Again, that's the Pueblo Unido PDX one-year anniversary on May 19th from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center, 5431 Northeast 20th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO hosts beloved Community in Action movie nights every third Thursday at 7 p.m. here at the radio station. On May 17th, we'll show the 2016 documentary, 13. The film explores the intersection of race, justice, and mass incarceration in the United States. It is titled after the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution.
It is on taking people from prison, putting them in community corrections, parole, and probation.
How much progress is it really if now there's a private company making money off the GPS monitor?
We now have more African Americans under criminal supervision than all the
states. Again, that's a screening of 13 for the KBOO Beloved Community in Action movie night on Thursday, May 17th at 7 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll be hearing about Merrill Hearst's decision to close down.
Union leaders arrested at the Volunteers of America.
And North Korea is backing out of the summit.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 17th, 2018. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. The Public News Service is a member-supported media outlet that aims to cover issues that may not be highlighted by mainstream media. In today's episode, net neutrality, Trump's lawyer, and elder care in Minnesota.
The Public News Service daily newscast for Thursday, May the 17th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. President Trump's financial disclosure referred to the Department of Justice. Also on the rundown, the U.S. Senate votes to block the FCC's rollback of net neutrality. Plus, we'll let you know why students want Nevada universities to divest from fossil fuels. Topping our news, President Trump's financial disclosure released Wednesday included for the first time a repayment of more than $100,000 to his personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, in the year 2017. The New York Times reports this is raising questions about whether Mr. Trump's sworn filing from a year ago improperly omitted that debt. The Times adds in a highly unusual letter, the Office of Government Ethics alerted the Justice Department Wednesday that the Ethics Office had determined that the payment that was made by Mr. Cohen is required to be reported as a liability. The U.S. Senate took a stand on open Internet protections Wednesday, voting 52-47 to stop the FCC's recent move to roll back net neutrality rules that were finalized under the Obama administration. Here's Eric Gallatis.
A similar bill will now go to the House, where a majority would need to sign on to force a vote. Tim Carr, with the group Free Press, says the Senate's action is an important step in unwinding what he calls one of the most unpopular policy decisions in the history of the FCC. He points to a recent University of Maryland study showing 86% of Americans oppose the rollback.
82% of Republicans support the net neutrality protections and oppose the FCC's recent decision to take those away. We're very hopeful that our members of Congress will do their jobs, which is essentially to represent the interests of the American public.
Supporters of open internet rules warned that a rollback would allow internet providers such as Comcast and Verizon to create fast lanes for their content and slow lanes for websites that couldn't pay. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and others argued that removing protections would return the internet to the same regulatory environment that helped it grow. Industry groups have also claimed that the rules have blunted investment.
The FCC's so-called Restoring Internet Freedom Order, reversing open internet rules, is scheduled to go into effect on June the 11th. Companion bills in Congress aim to increase oversight and put a moratorium on the additional construction of immigration detention centers. Eric Tegetoff has our report.
The Detention Oversight, Not Expansion, or DUN Act, introduced by Washington State Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal and California Senator Kamala Harris, is in part a response to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement's request to build five new facilities in the Midwest. Jayapal says detention centers are actually prisons and are inhumane, noting more than 170 people have died in ICE's custody since 2003. She says ICE has a process in place to inspect facilities, but it's ineffective.
What ICE does is they tell the facilities, okay, we're coming to investigate you now. We're coming to see if you're meeting the standards. And so you see a giant cleanup, essentially, right before the inspection happens.
The DUN Act would require the Department of Homeland Security's Office of the Inspector General to conduct unannounced inspections. Jayapal says facilities not in compliance would receive cuts in funding.
Eric tells us that private corporations oversee more than 60% of ICE detention beds. That's according to grassroots leadership. And with less than a week left in the Minnesota legislative session, Suzanne Potter reports it's unclear whether either house will pass meaningful elder care legislation.
Advocates for older people say abuse in assisted living facilities has reached crisis levels, with about 400 cases being reported across the country every week. Christine Sundberg with Elder Voice Family Advocates, co-author of a recent report about the problem, says the elder care industry is failing to put patient safety first, largely because of staff who are overworked, undertrained, and underpaid.
The industry's accepting more and more people with greater and greater needs, yet they aren't staffed to handle those needs.
She says in the worst cases, those staff members become callous toward their jobs and the people in their care. Minnesota is the only state in the country that doesn't require licensing for assisted living facilities. Opponents of licensing bills have claimed that severe abuse is rare and that more regulation could drive some care providers out of business.
On Wednesday, Governor Mark Dayton sent a letter to lawmakers asking for standalone bills. A House-backed bill by AARP and the Alzheimer's Association has been abandoned, while another less popular measure to study the need for elder care licensing has been wrapped into an omnibus bill. And finally, Catherine Davis Young tells us that college students in Nevada want the state's public universities to sell off financial holdings in companies that produce coal, oil, and other fuels that have been shown to contribute to climate change.
Hundreds of colleges in the U.S. and abroad have divested from fossil fuel investments in recent years. University of Nevada, Las Vegas junior Shelo Gumabon is working with about 50 other students across other university and community college campuses in the state to organize a petition. She says her peers are committed to fighting climate change.
We're all here doing this to have a sustainable future, you know, and without our push for it, then we can't make the future that we want to see. So that's why we're working so hard towards that.
Gumabon says students are asking the university system to instead make investments in renewable energy.
Nevada students are gathering signatures on their petition. They plan to take their proposal to the Board of Regents of the Nevada System of Higher Education in early June. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for Newsin' and Cruisin' with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we are online at publicnewsservice.org.
Merrill Hurst University is closing its doors after 125 years. The Merrillhurst Board of Trustees voted to stop all operations by the end of 2018 and return all property to the Sisters of the Holy Names of Jesus and Mary. In a statement on its website, the Merrillhurst Board of Trustees and university leadership pointed to consistently smaller enrollment numbers since the Great Recession as the main reason for closing. The statement went on to say that because Merrillhurst University monitored their situation closely, avoiding typical university closure problems such as loss of accreditation, mounting debt, recalled loans, and bad audits, the end-of-the-year close date will allow current students to possibly finish their education plans or transfer to other institutions this summer. Since 2013, enrollment at the university has dropped 50%, even as tuition fees grew nearly 20% in the last 8 years. 1,409 students on average were enrolled that year. Today, just 743 students are attending the school. Merrillhurst projected more declines next fall. It cited the university's financial and enrollment predicament as being similar to small liberal arts schools, some with religious foundations, that have closed or merged in the Northeast or Midwestern United States. However, Merrillhurst's demographic is not rural, and it is catered mainly to adult students. According to Inside Hired, religious schools can find themselves more challenged today than other universities as religious foundations shift or ebb. As the economy slowly recovers, adults may be returning to work instead of pursuing school. Based on online studies, including one from College Factual, Merrillhurst University has statistically low graduation rates, with 0% of first-time four-year students graduating on time in 2012. The rate increased to about 15% in 2017 and 30% by 2018. This is compared with a national graduation rate of about 32% for first-time four-year students. About 50% of students' graduation occurred within 6 years nationally. Merrillhurst was founded as a women's college, historically has been an experimenter, instituting a prior learning assessment program in 1976, adding online classes in 1996, and beginning a degree completions program in 1998. The Sisters of the Holy Names of Jesus and Mary plan for the property to be taken care of in alignment with their mission values.
A hearing is scheduled tonight at the University of Oregon in Portland to review the Portland Area Workers' Rights Board's information on labor and human rights violations in TriMet's Lyft paratransit service. TriMet's Lyft service primarily serves those with disabilities and the elderly. Although the Lyft service is managed by TriMet, TriMet outsources the service to First Transit, which is part of the multinational corporation First Group. The hearing will hear testimony from drivers and riders about labor and human rights violations they've experienced since First Transit took over the Lyft's paratransit service. The hearing will also present testimony on possible alternatives and solutions. This will take place from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. this evening at the University of Oregon in Portland, 70 Northwest Cooch Street, Portland, Oregon, 97209.
Oregon has announced that it will be getting rid of 450 old diesel buses. So what's in the cards for the new school buses? In conjunction with the Oregon News Service and the KBOO Evening News, here's more. Oregon has announced it will replace hundreds of old diesel-powered school buses. A new report suggests replacing them with electric buses is the best choice for children's health, the environment, and the state's coffers. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality says it will use money from the $72 million Volkswagen emissions cheating settlement to replace about 450 school buses. Both DEQ and the report from Environment Oregon note diesel emissions are dangerous for kids. Celeste Mayfern-Swango, Director of Environment Oregon, says emissions can worsen respiratory diseases and conditions such as asthma.
And the negative effects are especially pronounced in children. It's internationally recognized as a cancer-causing agent and classified as a likely carcinogen by the US EPA.
Mayfran Swango says zero-emission electric buses are capable of replacing diesel buses now. DEQ has not announced how the buses will be powered, but a 2017 law requires Oregon to upgrade older diesel school buses by 2025. The report suggests Oregon go further than school buses and replace transit vehicles with electric buses, too. The Chicago Transit Authority estimates it saves $80,000 per electric bus per year. The cost to build electric infrastructure could be a major roadblock at the outset, but Mayfran Swango says even when that's factored in, electric still saves cities money over the lifetime of a bus. She adds, the zero-emission fuel also saves on operating costs.
The upfront costs of electric buses are more than a traditional diesel bus, but we know that they are actually more affordable in the long run since they have 30% fewer parts, no exhaust systems, their braking systems last longer, and they don't require oil changes or fossil fuels.
She says Portland's TriMet Transit System is the state's largest purchaser of diesel buses. Environment Oregon is calling on TriMet to stop buying diesel buses by 2020. Buses have a lifespan of about 16 years. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service and KBOO News, I'm Tom Flynn.
Climate Connections is a daily podcast showcasing how climate change affects our daily lives and what we can do about it. On today's episode, how natural disasters affect our mental health.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In 2012, as Superstorm Sandy battered her oceanfront condo in Rockaway, Queens, Daris Garnes waited out the storm inland. When she returned home the next day, she was astonished by what she saw.
It kind of looked like a war zone. The boardwalk had broken and it was sitting in front of the door. The sand was so high it was over the fire hydrants. My fence was just broken into pieces. It was really a horrific scene.
Garn says she was one of the lucky ones. She was able to move back into her condo after about 2 weeks. But the storm's psychological toll wore on.
I didn't really know what was happening. I just knew that I just felt so bad for everybody, and I couldn't understand why, you know, I felt stuck and I didn't want to get back to normal routines.
Mental health symptoms such as depression and anxiety are common after natural disasters. Experts caution that as extreme weather events become more frequent with climate change, the need to provide mental health support will grow. For Garnes, coping became easier after she talked to a counselor.
It helps. It helps just to let some of your feelings out.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
And now it's time for Labor History in Two from host Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith. And this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1980. That was the day 4,000 strikers and their supporters gathered for the March for Dignity and Respect in Laurel, Mississippi. Over 200 mostly black women members of the International Chemical Workers Union, Local 882, had been on strike against Sanderson Farms chicken processing plant for 15 months. Trade unionists from as far away as Cincinnati, Memphis, and North Carolina came to march in support. Sanderson Farms had cleared $58 million in profit, but paid workers just $3 an hour. The women demanded a contract that included more control over assembly line speed, overtime pay, and insurance. They complained of desperately low wages, inhumane working conditions, and even the inability to use the bathroom when necessary. Workers were given only gloves and an apron once a month, and a file to sharpen their often dull and rusty scissors and knives. They often referred to the processing plant as the plantation, where sexual harassment was rampant. Women workers often found themselves given dangerous assignments or even fired if they didn't put up with sexual advances of their foreman. Workers maintained that strikebreakers from the community were desperately poor and threatened with violence if they quit by local Ku Klux Klansmen who worked as supervisors at the plant. Some were known to have been involved in the murder and/or intimidation of civil rights workers in decades past. The plant had been organized in 1972, but was extraordinarily weak. Nonetheless, women strikers understood that the union still served as an invaluable resource in the midst of a largely unorganized South. By the following February, the NLRB ruled that Sanderson had to resume contract negotiations and allow strikers to return to their jobs. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Northwest Labor Press issued a press statement on Tuesday detailing the arrest of certain members of Oregon AFL-CIO and about 10 other unionists on Monday, May 4th at the nonprofit Volunteers of America, also known as VOA, for what is being called civil disobedience. About 70 workers at the two addiction treatment centers overseen by VOA voted to join the AFS-CME in September of 2016, but VOA has stonewalled union contract negotiations by refusing to agree to a basic union contract provision known as union security. Union security requires that all union-represented workers join the union or at least pay a share of the union's costs. In other words, that a workplace be an open shop. Among those arrested were Oregon AFL-CIO President Tom Chamberlain, Oregon AFS-CME Executive Director Stacy Chamberlain, and Oregon AFSCME Organizing Director Corey Nicholson. Also arrested were Corey Nicholson, Graham Tainer, KBOO reporter and labor radio host Jamie Partridge, AJ Mendoza, Justin Kirsten Norton, Andrea Lemoines, Alan Smith, and Emily Wyant.
On today's episode of Black History 365, we take a look at the day segregation in schools was declared unconstitutional.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is May 17th. And on this day in 1954, the United States Supreme Court declares segregation in public schools unconstitutional in Brown versus Board of Education decision. This case was the consolidation of four cases arising in separate states relating to the segregation of public schools on the basis of race.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365. Bam! 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
The City Council of Boulder has voted unanimously to ban assault rifles within their borders. Deerfield, a suburb of Chicago, has previously enacted an assault rifle ban that includes fines as high as $1,000 a day. The ban also includes bump stocks and high-capacity magazines. Owners of such items will have until July 15th to dispose of them. This new ordinance does, however, include a grandfather clause. If owners can prove previous ownership, then they will be allowed to keep their weapons. This exception has not stopped some residents who have already filed suits against the new ordinance claiming second right infringement.
Republican Governor Phil Scott of Vermont signed a bill last Friday requiring all single-occupancy restrooms to be gender-neutral. The bill passed all three major political parties in the state. The law applies to schools, businesses, public buildings, and other public accommodations. Vermont's lawmakers are hoping that the new law will serve as a model for the rest of the United States. Governor Scott said, quote, "Vermont has a well-earned reputation for embracing equality and being inclusive. 2 years when I was running for governor, I was asked in a debate whether I would support gender-neutral bathrooms in public spaces or not. I responded with a one-word answer, a simple yes, because to me it was just that simple," end quote. Senator Becca Ballant A Democrat who originally brought the bill to the floor said, quote, "For trans people and gender nonconforming individuals, it provides safe public accommodations," end quote. According to the Maven and Associated Press, Nathan DeGroot, a Montpelier High School student who spoke with the outlets, said that it took 15 months after coming out as a transgender before he was comfortable entering a man's restroom. DeGroot said, quote, "There are people in the room who are purposefully do not drink more than a certain amount during the day just so they don't have to validate their entire existence every time they need to do the most natural thing in the world," end quote. The new law in Vermont goes into effect on July 1st.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Throughout Alaska, sexual assault and violent crimes disproportionately impact Alaska Native people. A group of citizens in Nome is calling for change in the handling of these cases. The city council says it's listening. Zoe Gruskin has more.
Work sessions of the Nome City Council usually draw little attention. Public attendance is rare. Last week, council chambers were filled as a group of citizens approached the council with their own resolution. It laid out what the group sees as shortcomings in the Nome Police Department's response to sexual assault and violent crimes. A central claim of the resolution was that Alaska Native victims do not receive equal treatment by the police. The document cited statistics on the prevalence of sexual violence against Alaska Native women, as well as common themes from the group's conversations, less easily captured by numbers. Before the reading of the resolution, Banganga Pungawi spoke about the lived experience of discrimination against Alaska Natives.
"We're told what our value is every single day. We know where we are on the hierarchy in this town, and we know it because the people that we love are being hurt and they're dying."
The group proposed a long list of changes to NPD policies and training. The senior councilman told the group that night, quote, "We have our homework." This week, City Council took up its own version of the resolution. It contained little policy. Mostly, it affirmed the council's commitment to providing a safe and inclusive community, and it declared support for both Alaska Native victims and NPD. The council and the citizens agree. This is just the start of the conversation. In Nome, I'm Zoe Gruskin.
Congress has passed the Oregon Tribal Economic Development Act, which allows tribes to lease and sell property they own. Tribes currently are required to get federal approval. Tribal leaders say this is often expensive and impacts economic development. It does not affect property held in trust. The bill now heads to the president's desk. A meeting is being held to explore how to enhance the experience of Native students at the University of Wyoming and partnerships with the Native community. The university's president has charged a subcommittee with developing a five-year plan to boost work with Native Americans. The listening session takes place Thursday in Riverton. A settlement has now been approved for victims of what's called the 60 Scoop in Canada. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the $875 million settlement came after a two-day hearing in Saskatoon.
The Canadian government announced the settlement in October. The offer included $750 million to the 20,000 survivors. That's about $25,000 apiece. It also includes $75 million to cover legal costs and $50 million for an Indigenous healing fund. At the end of the two-day hearing, a federal judge approved the settlement. Although there was opposition from some survivors, advocates say it ends the agony of the process, and after 9 years, enough is enough. The 60 Scoop came during a 40-year period beginning in 1951, in which Indigenous children were taken from their homes and placed into foster care with non-Indigenous families. Malika Pop is a Scoop survivor.
There is no amount of money that will ever make up for the loss, the harm, the trauma. But this settlement is a gesture toward reconciliation.
But some say the settlement is not enough for the loss of identity, culture, and language for so many Native children. Colleen Rajot went into the hearings opposed to the settlement.
They did not ask our opinion, and we are mad. And I am going in there today to stand up before the judge and all of those lawyers that are going to get rich on our backs, and I'm going to say to them, this is wrong.
Rajot says she will continue the fight. She wants the government to hold new meetings across the country. She says the settlement does not include Métis survivors, and in the end, she says the lawyers will get more money than the survivors. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Jewish Voices for Peace. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather in the Portland and Hood River area, partly cloudy with a low in the lower 50s, followed by cloudy weather and a high in the upper 70s. Today in history, in 1863, Rosalia de Castro published the first book in the Galician language. De Castro is a beloved Spanish poet whose choice of publishing in Galician, which was then considered an inferior language, was a bold and defiant step that forever endeared her to the public. The quote of the day is from composer and birthday boy Eric Satie. "I am by far your superior, but my notorious modesty prevents me from saying so," end quote.
On today's episode of the Trahant Report, we'll get to take a look at the Minnesota legislators' choice to weaken water standards and how this will affect wild rice, the essential Ojibwa food.
Water is life? Not so much in Minnesota. This is Trahant Reports. The Minnesota legislature, supported by the mining industry, last week voted to weaken water standards for sulfates in areas where wild rice grows. Wild rice is the essential Ojibwe food. The legislation is not final, and Governor Mark Dayton has not said whether he'll sign or veto the measure. Last month, when the bill was before the House, Representative Peggy Flanagan spoke against weakening the standards. Quote, "If wild rice no longer exists, we no longer exist. This is our home," she said. "We can't go anywhere else. So if Manoman goes away, we go away." Maybe that's the point. Flanagan is White Earth Ojibwe and the Democratic Farm Labor candidate for Lieutenant Governor. Mining companies, as well as northern Minnesota communities, complained that the water standards were too stringent and too expensive. PolyMet Mining Corporation has proposed a copper-nickel plant near Hoyt Lake. The mining permit has not yet been issued, but under the old rules, the company would have had to treat the open pit mine and tailings indefinitely to remove sulfate from the water. According to the Minneapolis Star Tribune, that would have cost the company about $1 billion. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has already said it will bring together scientists and policymakers to determine an alternative path forward. And other critics have said that an outright repeal of the water standards could violate the Federal Clean Water Act. One problem is that the old water quality standard was never enforced. Up until now, the standard had maintained that sulfate should not enter wild rice waters in higher quantities than 10 parts per million, says a blog post from Honor the Earth. The new proposed rule would make a different standard for every lake and wetland with wild rice, an unbelievably complicated and costly rule to implement. That is the rule that the Senate proposed be withdrawn. An op-ed by Kevin Dupuis, president of the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, and Catherine Hoffman with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy called the legislation a sellout to the very identity of Minnesotans. They wrote, "Tribes and environmental advocates might be the most vocal protectors of wild rice, but we know that the great unifier of Minnesotans is our water. Water is who we are. It is not too late. Minnesotans, lover of wild rice, lakes, and all waters, we must unite to protect our very identity." I'm Mark Trahant.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
And now it's time for This Week in Water.
During droughts, these pests will bite you more. That story and others on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The U.S. Geological Survey in Hawaii is warning that there could be massive eruptions of the Kilauea volcano in coming weeks after it first exploded on May 3rd.
Lava continues to sink inside the volcanic crater, and an influx of groundwater could lead to steam explosions launching ballistic projectiles as small as a pebble or as big as a car.
Ash clouds may rise to higher elevations and spread over larger areas. CNN reports that new vents on the ground miles east of the Kilauea summit have released slow-moving lava and toxic gas into communities.
Should winds weaken, the gases can combine with moisture to create volcanic smog, or VOG, containing acid droplets that can cause respiratory problems.
If precipitation occurs, the result will be acid rain with the corrosive properties of diluted battery acid, which can damage plants, cars, and buildings.
Some people on the island use catchment systems for their water, and officials are warning that they could be polluted from the ash in the air.
About 2,000 people have been forced to evacuate due to the lava flows, and about 24 homes have been destroyed.
Recently, a candidate for governor in Colorado offered a possible solution to the projected gap between the state's water supply and demand. His answer? Beavers.
There were some chuckles when he did so. The idea that beavers could solve what some project as a huge water deficit may seem odd at best.
But beavers could have a role in water quality issues, if not closing quantity gaps.
A recent study published in the journal Earth Processes and Landforms shows that beaver dams are natural filters for waterways. They can help stem the loss of valuable soils from farms and clean up polluted rivers and streams.
A single family of the critters at a research site covering about 6 acres, built 13 dams, and created a series of deep ponds along a small stream.
The scientists learned that the beaver ponds trapped sediment with high concentrations of phosphorus and nitrogen, usually coming from fertilizers, that can pollute human and wildlife water supplies.
The study was done in England, where beavers were thought to have been extinct until about 10 years ago, when a colony was discovered in Scotland.
Urban areas are losing something important for water and air quality, trees.
About 36 million trees in the U.S. are lost each year, according to a study from the Forest Service. Trees help reduce carbon emissions and can save energy around buildings by reducing the need for air conditioning. They also warm buildings by lowering wind pressure in colder months.
But as new roads and buildings are created, they increase impervious surfaces, and nearly 200,000 acres of tree cover are lost annually.
One of the scientists involved in the study told Popular Science that the value of trees in urban areas is more important than those in rural forests because they're closer to people.
Most people think that mosquitoes bite to get food from human blood, but according to a report from the University of Cincinnati, they also bite because they're thirsty.
Mosquitoes use meals of blood to replace the water they've lost, and they may transmit diseases like West Nile virus more frequently when it's dry, according to the researchers.
The insects seem to be more threatening after rains, when they lay eggs in standing water. However, the new research shows that dry conditions don't provide protection.
The study found that dehydrated conditions did not reduce activity and increased the propensity of mosquitoes to land and feed on a host.
Among animals, mosquitoes pose the deadliest threat to humans because of the diseases they spread, like malaria, which by itself kills about 400,000 people a year.
It doesn't take long for a mosquito to get dehydrated. They get thirsty within 2 to 3 hours in high temperatures and low humidity.
The flow of the Colorado River is expected to peak at the Utah-Colorado border Sunday, May 13th, which is quite early in the year.
According to the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel, this would be the third earliest peak flow from snowmelt runoff that supplies water to much of the Southwest.
While the peak is occurring early, the amount of water in the river is low. According to records from the Colorado River Conservation District, this year may be the fourth lowest in 85 years.
Forecasters are predicting that Lake Powell above Glen Canyon Dam will receive only about 40% of its long-term average.
But comparing what's happening to average years may be misleading, as H2O Radio has reported earlier.
According to a white paper from the Colorado River Research Group, the Southwest is entering a period of aridification in which drier conditions persist, instead of a drought with a distinct end.
And finally, people have used plants and animals to understand the environment for years. They're called bioindicators. Think canaries in mine shafts to detect gases. There are numerous examples.
Lichens are often used to assess air quality, since they don't have roots and get a lot of their nutrients from the atmosphere. Plants were used after the Chernobyl disaster to analyze soils after the nuclear meltdown. And a team of scientists in Copenhagen used a plant whose leaves changed from green to red when exposed to nitrogen dioxide gas in order to detect landmines.
Now, a researcher from Colorado State University is studying how bats locate usable water sources and detect its quality. Teresa Laverty spent 18 months in Namibia observing bats in the desert.
In this extreme arid region, freshwater pools are rare and rivers flow intermittently, so it can be hard for wildlife to find water. But because bats fly, they can find freshwater sources over large areas and may visit multiple ponds in a single night.
They're also picky. Laverty observed that bat activity was lower at springs with high salt concentrations. So by tracking the animals, people could locate high-quality water.
Water quality challenges aren't limited to African deserts. Groundwater pumping in many areas of the world is degrading aquifers, making them saltier, and road salts have affected freshwater bodies across the U.S.
About a third of bat species are endangered worldwide, all the more reason to protect them and follow their activity. A new kind of bat signal, perhaps? This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, bringing together the best and brightest minds in the water sector at ACE 18. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE18.
Kellogg's, the cereal company, shut down a factory in Venezuela due to strict currency regulations and a lack of raw material. The Venezuelan government then took over the factory. The company is warning people to not eat anything with Kellogg brand because it can't be vouched for. Currently, up to 70% of children in Venezuela's rural area suffer from acute malnutrition. In a country that is seeing a 13,000% increase in inflation this year, where pasta and rice can cost up to a month's worth of wages, the shutdown of a food manufacturing plant can be devastating. This isn't the first time the country has requisitioned a business. In 2016, a Kimberly-Clark, a toiletries factory, was taken over when they had to shut down for currency and control reasons, as well as the lack of material. Venezuela has one of the world's largest oil reserves, and yet the people there are still living on the brink of starvation.
Pyongyang decried the joint military exercises conducted by the United States and South Korea, calling the exercises intentional provocation, abruptly ending the months-long trajectory of warming ties. North Korea swiftly announced Tuesday that it was quitting the high-level talks with Seoul in protest of recent joint military exercises. Pyongyang has also issued a chilling word of caution to the U.S. about the planned June summit with President Donald Trump, suggesting that the fate of the historic meeting could be in peril if Washington insisted on unilateral nuclear abandonment. In response to the Seoul talks originally scheduled for Wednesday, North Korea's official Korean Central News Agency condemned the joint military exercises as a flagrant challenge to the declaration adopted by the two Koreas in April. In a statement yesterday, Kim Kai-kwan, North Korea's first vice minister of foreign affairs, said that Pyongyang would be forced to reconsider the summit if the U.S. insists on unilateral nuclear abandonment. Kim went on to attack the White House National Security Advisor John Bolton's earlier remarks that the U.S. would look to a Libya model for North Korea denuclearization based on Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's decision nearly 20 years ago to relinquish nuclear weapons. Kim said, quote, "It's absolutely absurd to compare North Korea with Libya," end quote.
According to world press institutions, including the Huffington Post, Italy is poising itself to become a closer ally to Russia. HuffPost released a leaked document it received today showing a draft contract outlining Italy's far-right Lega and anti-establishment five-star parties. Five-star parties plan in opposition to immigration. The contract, these parties state they want to immediately lift sanctions against the Kremlin, that have been in place since Russia annexed the peninsula of Crimea in 2014. The documents also describe heavy criticism of the European Union's response to migration, calling for stricter lines against those seeking asylum in Europe. In recent years, over 600,000 migrants have arrived in Italy. Immigration has become the foremost topic of Italy's election in March, which left no clear winner. The Eurosceptic Five Star and Lega parties have moved closer in the last month to agreeing on governing coalition. It is expected to be a deal that will give Italy one of the most populous governments in Europe. An earlier draft of the contract between the two parties, published by HuffPost Italia this week, caused concern across Europe as it revealed the parties wanted to take a combative stance towards the EU, eventually opting out of the Eurozone.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tom Flynn and Sam Bowman. The producer is Grace Ann Smith. Our engineer and KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Ellis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KABU News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Positively Revolting, guest host Linda Olson Osterlund welcomes your calls to discuss this week's election results. At 9, Veterans Voice Radio takes on the human cost of war. At 10, Valley Views talks to the director of the Corvallis Bike Collective about the services they provide and about the upcoming neighborhood street party. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, On the Ground Radio looks at the convergence of the movements for Palestinian human rights and Black Lives. Thanks, KABU members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Jewish Voices for Peace hosted a march in solidarity with multiple organizations and supported yesterday in downtown Portland. Some of the organizations were Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, Black Lives Matters, and the Poor People's Campaign. The route began at the Native Student Center, Community Center, and Portland State University and ended at Dawson Park for a Ramadan feast. The march stopped at various landmarks to allow attendees to listen to speakers. Topics decried the massacre in Gaza, the 70th anniversary of the Nakba, and the international atrocities happening to Palestinians that equally affect communities of color worldwide. KABU's Zelos Ellis Marchand spoke with Will Singer from the local chapter of Jewish Voices for Peace.
I have Will Singer on the phone, a local member of Jewish Voice for Peace. William, thank you so much for taking time to speak to KABU today.
Thank you.
So, we were just chatting about how quickly the march was moving yesterday.
And yes, it was just a wonderful scene. The weather was beautiful, and the sense of solidarity and community out on the street was wonderful. I mean, the horrible criminal events in Gaza are the very sad occasion for this gathering yesterday. But what was truly encouraging and inspiring for me, at least, was to see the growing community here working to change U.S. policy, which is really such a central point in trying to change the situation in Palestine, Israel, so that the Palestinians can finally reach some level of justice. And Gaza could not be it is such a horrible and terrifying example of the oppression and brutality of occupation by the Israeli state.
How many were in attendance in the march? I think at one point, as I was trying to catch up, I saw a group of you head towards Everett, I think. And I could definitely hear the throngs and the chanting. What would you say was the number and the energy of the group?
Well, the energy was immeasurably high, pegging the meter, as you'd say in the radio business. I'm notoriously bad at estimating crowds. I would say between maybe 150 and 200 people. But again, I'm not a good estimate of crowd size. What was wonderful was to see the diversity of the crowd. We had people from the immigrants' rights movement speaking. We had people from Don't Shoot Portland speaking. We had people, of course, from the Palestinian community, from the Jewish community. Two prominent rabbis were in attendance in the march. For me, these were the indications that the campaign and movement for Palestinian rights and self-determination in support of the Great March of Return in Gaza, that community is growing. And we see this in so many ways. And we were outside of Senator Jeff Merkley's offices, but of course we could have as easily and perhaps more appropriately been outside the offices of Senator Ron Wyden, who has been terrible on this issue. But what is encouraging is to see how many, all too few still, all too few voices in Congress, but how many more voices than we would have heard 5 or 10 years ago speaking out against this violence. I mean, the spectacle, for example, of Dianne Feinstein speaking out against the violence in Gaza is an indication that public opinion in this country has already shifted dramatically. I think that's a function of, I think it's a function in part of community radios like KABU that provide, you know, a semblance of truthful reporting. So that was, for me, what was most inspiring about yesterday. Yes, the crowd size, I would have loved to have seen thousands of people out there. But this is a growing campaign and a growing movement, and I feel that momentum is with us and with the Palestinian people.
Mm. Circling back to Senator Wyden, has he kept silent on this issue? Can you expound for our listeners who, like you say, are just, joining the sea change of political feeling? What is he doing or not doing that is not helping the Palestinians at this moment?
Well, I can. I think if you look for Senator Wyden to speak out on this issue in any manner or form, you'll find that there is no manner or form in which he is speaking in any way appropriate to the level of criminality and brutality and violence that the Israeli military is visiting upon the unarmed, peaceful protests in Gaza today. Senator Merkley has made some statements, not nearly as strong as we would like. He has spoken out against the disproportionality of Israeli violence, for example, in 2014 when the Israelis were attacking with such brutality, killing not dozens but thousands of Palestinians, innocent Palestinians in Gaza. Again, we have a long ways to go, but Senator Wyden, so I've spoken specifically to maybe statements he's made, and I can speak on a personal level that when we talk to staffers at, for example, Congressman Blumenauer's office, or even Congressman Blumenauer, or Senator Merkley's office and his staff, we are received in a civil fashion and often, and we get a sympathetic hearing and often very informed questions about what's going on, and often the people involved are very informed of the events. That is not at all the reception we get when we speak with Senator Wyden's staff. It is a level of hostility that is quite disturbing for me as an American citizen, as a citizen of the state of Oregon, and as you know, a Jewish American. I haven't met with that kind of hostility from a Democratic senator, not since days that I would visit and see Gordon Smith's staffers, where there was a similar level of hostility directed against us when we talked about Palestine, for that matter, when we talked about issues like East Timor. This is quite a number of years ago. So it's in that sense that I think we have a lot, we have a farther to go with someone like Senator Wyden, and I would say, really, we're not going to get anywhere with him. We need to replace Senator Wyden with someone who is actually progressive in a strong, radical sense of progressive. But with Senator Merkley, I, and I'm sure comrades of mine in this campaign and movement would disagree with me, but I still have some hope that Senator Merkley will begin to speak out more strongly on this issue. You know, the Democratic Party is itself very problematic. I mean, people are complaining about, oh, it's horrible, this President Trump moving the embassy. But let's keep in mind that sort of the alpha Democrat, Chuck Schumer, supported this, applauded this. And you know, to go just a little bit of a field from the issue of Israel-Palestine, something like five Democrats are going to be voting to confirm this new head of the CIA, this torturer, this destroyer of evidence of torture. So we have a long way to go across the board, across a set of issues. But again, for me, what is hopeful is that things have changed in this country. More people are speaking out. You had a presidential candidate, Bernie Sanders, speaking out on these issues and has been speaking out on these issues for a number of years. That is a hopeful sign, and that it should encourage us to continue the work of organizing our community. We know here in Portland there are many more people who would be marching with us if they knew about these kinds of action, if they were to become involved. We could have a movement that could change the politics in this country significantly.
Well, after last night's local elections, it seems like there's definitely a force of change happening here in Portland for the better.
It is encouraging, yes. Oh, my gosh. Ms. Hardesty may well be on our city council is such a hopeful thing indeed.
I think all of Portland metropolitan area was on pins and needles checking various Facebook and KATU links to see who was ahead of who last night.
You know, in some ways I was hoping that we would get more television cameras, more radio. It was so wonderful to have KABU out there, of course. But the confluence of the election night and Nakba Day, you know, we hate to compete with other progressive campaigns. On the other hand, isn't it wonderful that so many progressive campaigns were peaking in the last couple of days? The new Poor People's Campaign, Working People's Campaign, these progressive candidates being triumphant or nearly triumphant last night. And then the Nakba Day protests and demonstrations that happened across this country, not just in Portland, and, of course, throughout the world. So, you know, as I said when I spoke yesterday, we need to work together. I know it sounds overly sentimental when I say things like this. We need to love one another in our communities. And when we disagree with each other, we need to find ways to work through those disagreements in a comradely and, yes, even loving way, so that we build our community and not fracture our community with our disagreements.
The time is 5:59. You are listening to KBOO Portland. That clip should have mentioned that march took place Tuesday evening, not yesterday, to those who are confused. Up next, the one and only Rose Sadie Native Radio and the Power Hour.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Nat Turner Project book release on Thursday, May 24th at 6:30 p.m. at City Hall in Portland. The Nat Turner Project allows artists of color to go beyond the usual initial expositions inherent in presenting art born of marginalized perspectives to a dominant culture, and creates an environment of inclusivity, a communal harbor for artists previously silenced by institutional